are now ready to start our third and final panel discussion of the day. Its theme is Bipartisanship and High-Profile Congressional Investigations. We are pleased to have with us another great panel and another great moderator. Our moderator is Justin Rood. Justin is the director of POGO's Congressional Oversight Initiative. Previously, he served under Senator Tom Coburn on his Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee as Director of Investigations on Homeland Security Matters. Prior to that, he worked under Senator Coburn as a senior investigator on the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, Minority Staff. And before that, Mr. Rood was an award-winning investigative producer and reporter with ABC News and other outlets. His undergraduate degree is in American and United States Studies from Pitzer College. With that, Justin, thank you for joining us, and thank you for offering to moderate this great panel.
Thank you, and thanks for having us. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here, especially because we have a fantastic panel of folks to talk about congressional oversight today. To my immediate right is Elise Bean. Elise is the co-director of the Levin Center at Wayne Law. She was counsel for former Senator Carl Levin and spent many years as his staff director and chief counsel for the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, where I first got to know her and work with her. At PSI, she led many successful investigations on a range of issues from money laundering, foreign corruption and offshore tax abuses, to the collapse of Enron and the 2008 financial crisis. She's the author of a new book, Financial Exposure, Carl Levin Senate Investigations into Finance and Tax Abuse. And since we're outing everyone from where they went to school, she got her undergraduate degree from Wesleyan and her law degree from the University of Michigan Law School. To her right, we have Stanley Brand, who is a senior counsel at Akin Gump. His practice covers all levels of state and federal courts with an emphasis on defending the rights of witnesses involved in government investigations. Mr. Brand has represented numerous individuals and organizations investigated by and or called to testify before Congress. He previously served as general counsel to the House of Representatives under Tip O'Neill, which was the subject of a fantastic podcast I just listened to. I recommend it to everyone. His undergraduate degree is from Franklin and Marshall College. His JD is from Georgetown University. And to his right is John Scledaney, the chief counsel for oversight to the minority on the House Committee on Financial Services. He previously served as the staff director at what was until recently known as the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. His undergraduate degree is from the College of William and Mary, and his JD is from George Mason. So we'll start with presentations from each of our panelists. Elise, would you like to go first?
Sure. Okay. Maybe I should turn that on. So there are two models of congressional oversight that I think are going to duke it out in the 116th Congress. One is looking at oversight as a substantive mechanism to get information and perform the function of checks and balances in our government. The other model is oversight as political theater. And the story of the 116th Congress is which one of these models is really going to win out. The authority to investigate is not laid out in the Constitution, but the Supreme Court found that it was inherent in the legislative functions carried out by Congress. If you're going to legislate, if you're going to appropriate, if you're going to nominate, wouldn't it be a good thing to get the facts? In addition to getting information so that you can act in an informed manner, we have the separation of powers under the Constitution, the idea that one part of government will act as a check on the other parts to prevent abuses. Those are really the two main purposes, from my eyes, for congressional oversight. But there's another view of oversight, which is political theater. In other words, it's not really to get information, it's not really to check abuses, it is really to score points. It's to set up elections, it's to persuade a popular opinion. To me, that's a corruption of oversight. That's not what it's about as far as the Supreme Court is concerned, but I have to admit it's got some validity as a way of understanding what happens in Congress in some hearings. One thing to think about in the 116th Congress that's new is Speaker Pelosi. She's really set a tone and provided a role model for House committee chairs doing oversight. I think some of her messages are avoid the extreme rhetoric, don't act off the cuff, assert the power of a responsible, co-equal branch of government. And I think that's the message that she's been giving. And we have committee chairs in the House in particular that have been really around the block before. So we've got people like Elijah Cummings at Oversight and Reform, Frank Pallone at Energy and Commerce, Jerry Nadler at Judiciary. If you just go down the list, we have very experienced people. Maxine Waters at Financial Services, Richard Neal at Ways and Means, Raul Grijalva at Natural Resources. The list goes on and on. These are people who have been in the majority before. They know that oversight can help drive real change, and it can be something much more than just theater. If we look at what's happened so far in terms of what's coming up, there's a real tension in oversight. Nobody knows exactly what's going to happen. There's a lot of pressure from the media and from the base of both parties to sort of take those short-term, feel-good, cheap shots versus having a more long-term, bipartisan type of investigation. At the Levin Center, we think bipartisan investigations are still the gold standard. It's easier to get information when both sides are looking for it. You get better analysis when you do investigations with people who have different viewpoints. Different people ask for different details. They understand the facts differently. They understand the issues differently. And you get your end product is more thorough, it's more accurate, and usually it's more credible if both sides are involved. So we think that's the gold standard, but the question is, what's really going to happen? And there are different ways you can analyze what's going on. For example, House Armed Services Committee announced it wanted to have a hearing looking at the whole thing of sending troops to the border. Now, you could look at that as a partisan issue, but a different way to look at it is, are we performing, is Congress performing that separation of powers, checks and balances function that the Constitution envisioned? It could go either way. The topic, depending on how it's handled and who's involved and how the hearing unfolds, it could go either way. There are a lot of other hearings like that as well. At Oversight and Reform, their first hearing was about price gouging in the drug industry. That's really a bipartisan concern. President Trump has expressed many times his concern about excessive drug prices, but it depends on, again, how it's going to unfold. That same committee invited Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross to talk about adding a citizenship question to the next census. Again, you could see that as a partisan issue. On the other hand, you could see it as Congress performing the function it's really supposed to be doing. And there are other examples. We can go on. Energy and Commerce, traditionally a pretty bipartisan committee in the House. They're looking at drug prices in terms of companies violating patent limits. They're looking at the impacts of the shutdown. Again, could see it as a partisan political theater, or you could see it as, no, let's really talk about shutdown as a policy matter. What are the problems? They also take into account cybersecurity, something that Senator Graham was just talking about. Looking at it, they've been actually going on an agency-by-agency basis trying to analyze their cybersecurity safeguards. So there's a lot of possibility for bipartisan, meaningful, intellectually honest oversight, but again, that temptation is to go turn everything into a political conversation. That's certainly what the media likes. If you tell the media we have a bipartisan hearing coming up, they go, oh, that means it's boring. I don't need to cover it. There's a lot of bipartisanship that still goes on in this Congress. People know that bipartisan inquiries really drive change, whether it's legislation, appropriations, nominations. And a lot of people still work very hard to reach out to the other side. So I'm hopeful about what's going to happen. Certainly, I just want to give one last example, is Ways and Means. One of the things they're looking at are the Trump tax returns. Now, it's easy to say that's a partisan approach, but if your intention is to embarrass the president, that's not a constitutional basis for congressional oversight. That couldn't fly in court. But on the other hand, if the reason you want to look at those tax returns are, well, here's a very wealthy person who apparently doesn't pay much taxes. How did that happen? What's going on in our tax code that allows people legally to not pay taxes despite having very high incomes? Are there real estate tax deductions that are overly generous? Then you get into a substantive policy discussion. Are there things in his tax returns that might indicate conflicts of interest, either domestic or foreign? Again, a more substantive concern. If that's why you're looking at those tax returns, well, then you have a very good chance of surviving a court challenge. So again, we're going to have to see how things play out. There's a tension, there's a testing going on, both with the public and within Congress and with the Trump administration. Congress's approval rating right now is hovering around 15%. It could go lower, but oversight actually has an opportunity. If Congress does it well in a bipartisan, intellectually honest way, they could actually improve the reputation of Congress and help to start to restore public confidence in Congress.
Great. Stan?
Thank you. Just riffing off Senator Graham's comment about everybody's been the lawyer has been the butt of a joke. In 1982, I was counsel to the House when Madeline Murray O'Hare, who some of you might be old enough to remember, was an atheist and sued over prayer in the public schools. And then she turned her ire to the House chaplain and she sued the chaplain alleging that the chaplain was an unconstitutional establishment of religion. So it fell to me to defend that case. And it got to the D.C. Circuit in banc. It was a very volatile and acrimonious oral argument. And after the argument, I walked out with the House chaplain, whose office, ironically, was right next door to mine. We used to trade off clients. And he turned to me and he tugged on my sleeve very plaintively and he said, "Stan, how do you think it went?" And I said, "Chaplain, I can only say it's a very sad day when a man of the cloth turns to a lawyer to be saved." We did save him. Well, I think Elise's foundation is excellent to go off of. And what I'm concerned about mostly is when Congress gets to an impasse with the president or the Justice Department over subpoenas, as they inevitably will, how in the world is that going to be resolved? And when the press breathlessly calls me for comment when subpoenas are issued and say, "Oh my God, a subpoena has been issued." And I, without being too flip, will say, you know, call me in 2 years when the litigation battle is over. Don't put a headline out that a subpoena has been issued, because in truth, it's just a piece of paper. It has to be enforced. Now, what is the history of enforcement of congressional subpoenas against executive branch officials? Going all the way back to 1982, when I was counsel to the House, and we, several House committees subpoenaed the administrator of the EPA during an investigation into oversight of the Superfund law. And the administrator of the EPA was Ann Gorsuch. Yes, that Gorsuch, the mother of the new Supreme Court justice. And the committee subpoenaed the records. To make a long story short, the Justice Department asserted executive privilege. Ronald Reagan signed the claim of privilege over what was called enforcement-sensitive files, because what the committee wanted to find out was, how are they administering the Superfund? Are they doing it properly? And does it need amendment or change? And the department took the position that, well, that's interfering in our law enforcement processes by looking over our shoulder at the decisions we have made or about to make on individual cases. And so they got to an impasse, and the committee referred Ann Gorsuch to the floor for contempt. I think the highest ranking of government official ever held in contempt by a vote of the House, maybe Eric Holder later in the process. And by a bipartisan vote with 70 Republicans joining the Democrats in a case putting the Republican-appointed administrator in contempt, the case was sent off to the U.S. Attorney under the contempt statute, 2 U.S.C. 192, except that, unlike virtually every case that had been brought under the statute since 1857, the department determined not to present it to the grand jury, even though the statute says shall. There's a separate debate about whether they have the discretion not to send it to the grand jury under that section. They turned around and at the stroke of 11 o'clock at night, after the contempt, they filed a lawsuit against the House of Representatives, styled U.S. v. U.S. House of Representatives, if you can get your head around that. My position in the court was, well, you can't be the United States if you're not enforcing the sovereign's laws. So the most you could be would be the executive branch versus the House of Representatives. We moved, their theory was this should be settled in a civil way, not under the criminal statute, and that the whole contempt process as applied to Gorsuch was unconstitutional because it unnecessarily burdened the president's claim of privilege. That lawsuit was quickly dismissed on motion by the House of Representatives, which I filed and argued, and the judge held that no, if you have defenses to the congressional subpoena, like executive privilege, tell it to the jury and the judge in your contempt case. And until a contempt case is actually presented, your claims of executive privilege won't have to be determined by this court. After the dismissal of the case, the department did not seek an appeal. And the committees negotiated with the department. I negotiated with a guy named Ed Schmaltz, who was deputy attorney general. And we reached a agreement where the committee got access, in fact, actually got copies of some of the records. And the case went away. However, it spawned progeny, which we live with to this day, which is essentially that subpoenas for executive branch officials raising claims of privilege who were referred via the statute to the U.S. attorney are never going to be prosecuted or have their case presented to a grand jury because the department has taken the institutional position through both Democratic and Republican administrations. Although this was invented by my good friend and colleague Ted Olson when he was at the Justice Department, Democratic administrations jumped on this theory as well. And so the Department of Justice's position became, we're never going to enforce this statute against an executive branch official who's claiming privilege, which has forced the House to resort to, ironically, the civil lawsuit mode that we moved to dismiss in 1982. So there are two cases, Harriet Myers during the Bush administration and the Judiciary Committee's investigation of the firing of various U.S. attorneys, where the House passed a resolution. Irv Nathan, then the House counsel, went off to federal court, filed a declaratory judgment action, and the case was heard by Judge Bates. Judge Bates got past all the jurisdictional and jurisprudential threshold arguments about standing, ripeness, et cetera, and ruled that the case was properly in the court. But that took almost a year without ever getting to the merits. Eventually, the party settled because they were afraid of an appeal where they might lose something important for the future. The bottom line of it being, and then the Holder case, which was the Fast and Furious investigation conducted by Oversight, I believe, in the Holder era, where they went off to court, and that case, I think, was 6 years in the making or more. So it's maybe ongoing, yes. It's not, John advises me, it's still on the docket. So what I'm going to conclude with is this notion that there is really no speedy, efficient way to resolve congressional subpoena battles between the president and the Congress. And if what we expect to happen is a series of investigations, even well-founded ones that are not blatantly or prima facie exercises of political theater, are going to take a long time to resolve because there's only one way that that can happen, and that is through a civil lawsuit. And of course, the Article III judges are reluctant to referee disputes between the branches unless there is no escape from doing so. When private parties are involved, they are much more likely to cross that threshold, as they did in the Steele seizure cases or other cases. But where it's the president and the Congress banging heads, They don't want to be the referees, even where the House or the Senate shows up with standing and has a, you know, a live case or controversy. So, yes, there will be a lot of drama in the fight between the newly run Democratic committees in the House and the executive branch, and there will be a lot of lawyer time and effort spent. How this will ultimately get resolved in our lifetime is another question. And maybe what that counsels is that we have to find other ways. Now, I'm a litigator, so I thrive on that type of action. And if it is the duty of the courts to say what the law is, then they should be able to say it with respect to congressional subpoenas. So I look forward to it from a lawyer's standpoint, but from an oversight standpoint or a efficiency of government standpoint, I think it's going to be a very long couple of years. And what the House committees are going to have to do and be very careful about is husbanding the cases that they bring to court. They're going to have to make some very difficult decisions about what kind of case to bring, what kind of record to make to substantiate, as Elise points out, the basis for their oversight, and be patient in dealing with the courts, because once it gets into court, that's really just the beginning. And so, you know, you're going to hear a lot of things about the Congress's ability to investigate, to have the public know. Of course, that's not the basis for congressional oversight. The so-called informing function that the Congress has is to inform itself in connection with its Article I capabilities, not to publish the work to the world what it is involved in. That may be a byproduct, but that can't be the purpose. So we're going to be witnessing, I think, a very active and interesting set of legal issues that will play out over the next year or more as we see whether and how the Congress can enforce their right to have this information.
So, John, in an era of bitter partisanship with powers that are of limited utility, at least in the short term, within the event horizon of a Congress, how do you manage to get anything done?
That's a very good question, and I think Elise and Stan hit on exactly the challenge.